Okay, good evening, everybody. I want to begin by thanking everybody here for coming. It is not always easy to come out on a Thursday night, but of course, we all know why we're here and why it's important to be here. So I thank all of you for making the effort to be here this evening. I want to thank also so many people who made this evening possible. Our president, Drew Barber, Jess Mirsky, who helped us a lot with coordinating this event, Daniel Lowe, the chair of our Adult Education Committee, Mark Levinson, National Board Chair of ZOA and Chair of the New Jersey Israel Commission and a good friend of Young Israel of TNEC, Scott Reese and the Young Israel of TNEC security team, and of course our TNEC Police Department, who always we have so much appreciation for all the work they do. On behalf of all the residents of TNEC. I want to also note the presence of a number of local elected officials and community leaders who have joined us this evening. We want to welcome TNEC Mayor Michael Pagan, Deputy Mayor Danielle G, TNEC Town Council Member Karen Organ, Council Member Schwartz will be here in a little bit, he's coming from the city. We want to thank Jason Shamis, CEO of the Jewish Federation of New Jersey, for being here. And Dan Schultzman, the president of the Jewish Federation of Northern New Jersey, both for being here this evening. For a few days, maybe even a few weeks, after the atrocities of October 7th, many of us marveled at how, for what felt like the first time, the world seemed to understand. They could see the depravity of the enemies that we face as a people, and they were able to support our right to defend ourselves against that enemy. Of course, it took only a short while, and as we could have easily predicted, there were now many voices who began to deny the undeniable and to defend the indefensible. They refused to see the difference between an army that aims to shield and defend the innocent and terrorists who shield themselves by using the innocent. They refused to acknowledge the atrocities carried out against women, children, and the elderly. And they cried genocide against the state of Israel. At the very same time that Israel is defending itself and its people from enemies who declare out loud every single day and write in their charters their determination to carry out the genocide against the people of Israel. And it's in the face of a world that seems, at least in some places, to have lost its way, that we need spokespeople, individuals who have knowledge, the skill, the backbone, and the fortitude to speak the truth about the reality of the people and army of Israel, the reality of the enemy that we face, and the reality of the just war that we are fighting. Our guest this evening, M.K. Danny Luz, has been doing just that, spending so much of his time and energy over the past 5 months, not only working generally for the people of Israel as a member of the Knesset, but playing a vital role in being a voice for the Israeli government on the international stage. Born in Canada, M.K. Luz has been a member of the Knesset for the Likud Party since January 6, 2023. His significant roles include serving on the Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee and chairing the Subcommittee for International Trade, positions that underscore his deep involvement in shaping Israel's defense policies and international trade relations. M.K. Luz is also recognized for his active presence in international media, where he regularly defends Israel's stance on various platforms, including Fox News, CNN, News Nation, The Hill, and more. This combination of political involvement and media presence makes him a key figure in Israeli politics and a respected voice in discussions about Israel's place in the world. Danny Luz's journey from Montreal, Canada to the Israeli Knesset is marked by dedication and service. Born to Moroccan Jewish parents, he pursued a degree in law from McGill University and a degree in public policy from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. After moving to Israel in 2009, Luz quickly became involved in local governance, serving as a city councilor in Jerusalem before making his mark on the national stage. In 2022, Iluz sought election to the Knesset as a member of the Likud Party, successfully entering the Knesset in early 2023. His tenure is distinguished by his contributions to the Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee and his leadership as the chairman of the Subcommittee for International Trade. These roles highlight Elu's commitment to enhancing Israel's security, economic relations, and trade partnerships globally. It is a great honor and a great privilege to introduce M.K. Danny Luz.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I know it's not easy to come on a Thursday night, and so I want to say thank you for making a special effort to be here tonight. I was going to start by speaking a little bit about myself, but I don't want to ruin the incredible introduction that you made. So thank you also for your kind words about these things. We're right now in a critical time in Jewish history. We're in a turning point in Jewish history. And that started 5 months ago. We're right now exactly 5 months since October 7th. And I want us to look back a little bit on what happened on October 7th. And then together try to understand how critical this time is for us as a people. And try to look forward at where we can move forward together. So I'll say a few things that you all already know, but it's important for us 5 months afterwards to take the time to digest these things and to remember them again. On October 7th, Israel was attacked brutally. I remind you that we were not at a war on October 6th. There was a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas on October 6th, but we were attacked brutally, surprised, by a terrorist group, Hamas, and other associated groups, Islamic Jihad. And the only way to put it is that we saw the face of evil revealed. The attack was probably the worst attack against the Jewish people since the Holocaust. Not only because of the number of people that were killed, 1,200 Jews murdered in one day, the day in which the most Jews were murdered since the Holocaust, but also because of the way in which they were murdered. We're talking about children that were burnt alive, women that were raped and flaunted around in the streets of Gaza, paraded around. We're still waiting for the international community to condemn these things. Elderly abducted, still being held today, 5 months afterwards, without proper medication, without showing signs of lives. All of the international human rights that they have being completely ignored. And so we've seen the face of evil, not only because of the extent of the people that were killed, but also because of the way in which they were killed. My friend, the Speaker of the Knesset often says when he speaks to international groups, it's as if the Holocaust came back for one day. Of course, the Holocaust was many of these one days over and over and over again for many years. So it's hard to compare. But it's as if for one day we had this perspective of what it was at that horrible time. Now, when we in Israel saw this face of evil, we understood that we have only one choice. And that only one choice is to eradicate this face of evil. Because sometimes in history, when there's an evil that's been revealed, your only choice is to eradicate it. That's what happened when the free world defeated the Nazis. That's what happened when the coalition of countries defeated ISIS. And that's what had to happen now, when Israel went into this war against Hamas. Since then, we've been in a war, a difficult war, with Hamas. We started militarily by attacking through the air. Afterwards, we went in and we started through with the northern parts of Gaza, then the central parts of Gaza, and then we started also dealing with the southern parts of Gaza. The most southern part of Gaza, Rafah, is still a place which we haven't gotten into. Now, the reason why we took all of this progression and these steps slowly, 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 is because Israel was very careful when it came to civilian lives in Gaza. And so when we attacked the northern parts of Gaza, we told all of the civilians to go down south. And when we went into the middle parts of Gaza, the same thing. We told them to go down south. And Israel has shown that it cares about civilian lives, unlike our enemies that have shown on October 7th that they not only don't care if they cause civilian deaths, they target civilians. I want to remind you, they went into people's homes in order to kill them. They didn't look for soldiers in order to fight a fair fight. They went into people's homes. They found their children and they killed them. They found the women, they raped them and then abducted them. That's what that's the people we're talking about. And so on the one hand, you have this country that cares very deeply about civilian lives. On the other hand, you have Hamas that targets civilian lives. You couldn't have a more clear contrast. But the contrast is even more clear than that. Because while we care about their civilians, they don't care about their own civilians. They use their civilians as human shields. One thing that we've had a challenge as Israel in the beginning of this war is that as we were telling the people to move down south from northern Gaza in order to avoid the war, we saw that Hamas armed guards were stopping the civilians from going down. And so I'm sure you've all seen the pictures, but there are these incredible pictures of Israeli tanks protecting Palestinian civilians that are going down south in order to ensure that Hamas doesn't hurt them for wanting to spare their lives as civilians that are caught in the crossfire. Israeli tanks protecting Palestinian civilians from Hamas. It's clear that Israel actually cares more about civilian lives of the Palestinians than Hamas ever did and does. And so again, the contrast couldn't be clearer between those two countries. You have one country that is based on freedom, that is a democracy, that sees itself as part of the free world and is definitely a part of the free world. And you have another country that's led by a terrorist group. It's not a country, yes, but it's in a certain sense, it's a territory that was managed by a terrorist group and that was built upon this Islamic, hateful, terrorist ideology. And so the contrast is very clear. And this brings me back to what I said in the beginning. We understood on October 7th that we had only one option. And that option was to completely defeat Hamas, to completely eradicate this evil group that committed this heinous crime on October 7th. Now, I want to go a little bit deeper as to why this is important. Because as I said, when you see the face of evil, you have to defeat it. But in the current case, I think that there are extra reasons why it's incredibly important for us to win this war in a very, very clear and decisive way. The first reason goes to the very depths of what Zionism means. You know, when Zionism was established, there were many different reasons. Some people spoke about religious reasons why Zionism was important. Some people spoke about historical reasons of the Jewish people coming back to their land. Some people spoke about philosophical reasons, nationalist reasons. There were a bunch of reasons. But there was one reason that connected everyone. It's like, I don't know if you guys know about the pyramid of Maslow, the needs of Maslow. It's a psychologist, that said that people have different needs, but before they get to the higher needs, to the important needs that they might have that are higher such as self-fulfillment and things like that, they first need the most basic needs, such as food and things like that, and survival. And so as a nation, there's the same things. There are some very high reasons why Zionism was important, but there was also one very, very basic reason. And that basic reason was that we wanted to create a safe haven for the Jewish people. We wanted to ensure that there was one place where the Jews could defend themselves. And after the Holocaust, when all around the world people screamed, "Never again," for us as Jews, the creation of the State of Israel was probably the greatest embodiment of this slogan. We now had a state, an army, that could ensure that never again. Now, as I said in my opening, and the things I said in the beginning, unfortunately, it happened again for one day, but it happened again. And we had this horrible day in which the face of evil once again was able to do what it did. Now, for something to happen, it happens. The history is full of these tragedies that happen. The question now is, how do we respond to this? How do we respond to this tragedy that happened, to this group that decided to try and commit genocide against the Jewish people? Do we sit back or do we fight back? Do we fight back until we defeat them? Are we able to give a message to history that says that when we said never again, we actually meant it? We meant it. And since October 7th, this is exactly what we're trying to do. To show history that when a genocidal extremist group attacks our nation, we're not just going to sit back. We're going to defend ourselves. And we're going to defeat them. And we're going to eradicate this group while protecting the civilians, while following international law. But we're going to defeat this terrorist group, and we're going to completely eradicate it. Now, it's not only Israel and Zionism that's on the line. I think it's also the free world as a whole. Because if October 7th goes on and happens without a proper response and without giving the clear message that a group that does such actions, the result of that action is total destruction, then what this creates is an incentive for terrorist groups to do this over and over again. It becomes an inspiration to do this over and over again. And if instead of total eradication, what happens is that Hamas is dealt a blow, but it survives, it regroups, it rebuilds, and then it does October 7th again and again and again, then it gives a message to history that you can do these actions and get away with it. And that's a problem not just for us as Jews and as Israelis. And it's a problem for us because not only is Hamas looking how we respond, but also Lebanon is Hezbollah in Lebanon is looking at how we respond. And Tehran is looking at how we respond. But it's not only a problem for us as Jews. It's a problem for the free world as a whole. Because there are radical elements that want to hurt the free world everywhere. And when they see that terrorists can get away with such actions, then they'll just do them over and over and over again. And that's something that the free world cannot live with. Now, I see the current situation as a very clear moment in history where there are two very clear paths of where we can move forward. You know, as part of being a member of Knesset, I'm also the head of the caucus for the Abraham Accords. I really believe in the Abraham Accords. I think that they're a very positive turning point in history. And ever since October 7th, people have asked me, Dan, before October 7th, there were talks about making the Abraham Accords broader, bringing in Saudi Arabia, deepening the ties with the Abraham Accord countries, maybe other countries also that want to come in. Is this still possible or not? So I want to say something very clear. The only way to move forward with the Abraham Accords is by dealing a total destruction of Hamas, is by defeating Hamas, is by winning the war. If we win the war, then there's a chance for peace with Saudi Arabia, and there's a chance for peace and the Abraham Accords and moving forward on that path. If we don't, then it won't happen. Why? There are a few reasons. The first reason is because the Saudis are also watching, and not only the Saudis, but other actors also. And, you know, I can't quote specific people, but I'm in touch with many people in the Emirates and in Bahrain. And ever since October 7th, the messages that they send me about what they want to see us do to Hamas are things that Israeli officials are not allowed to say. Let's put it this way. They want us to beat Hamas as much as we want to beat Hamas, if not more. Because they understand that Hamas and the Islamic Brotherhood are threats not only to Israel, but to any country that wants to see the Middle East move forward in a positive path. And they understand that. The second reason is very clear also. They want to make peace with a strong country, not with a weak country. I mean, you can look back at history and see that every single time that Israel actually achieved peace with a country, it was when it showed strength, not weakness. And so the only way for us to move forward in this path of peace, prosperity, and progress for the whole of the Middle East is for us to have total victory in Gaza and to eradicate Hamas. The other path, I said there's two very clear paths. So the path of victory leads to the potential of peace. I can't promise you that it will happen, but there's a very good chance and the potential is there. The other path is a path of emboldening the terrorists, getting into a cycle of violence that never ends, and seeing October 7th coming over and over and over again. And unfortunately, what we learn also from history is that it can always get even worse. We never thought that October 7th would happen, but you know, when we embolden terrorists, then they find ways to make it even worse and worse and worse. And so the two paths are very clear. I don't think that they've been ever clearer than they are right now. And that's why we in Israel understand that we have no other option but total victory. I want to end, before opening up for questions, with a few silver linings. It's tough to find silver linings in such a difficult period and situation with such tragedies that we've described. But I do want to speak about a few silver linings of things that we've seen in Israel since this war started. First of all, if you would have invited me here to speak on October 6th or before, then the topic of the discussion would probably would have been either judicial review or the judicial reform, or the very deep divisions that there are in Israeli society. Ever since October 7th, Israel has never been as united as it is today. Not only politically, we have a unity government, which is surviving, even though it has different challenges. And it's not easy politically to hold such a unity government. But that doesn't really matter. What really matters is that the people of Israel are as united as they've ever been. I mean, on October 7th itself, you've had settlers from Judea and Samaria that want to defend kibbutznikim that are from the left, that were living on the border with Gaza. And up until today, you hear these kibbutznikim that say how they didn't know that there were people that in Judea and Samaria that would risk their lives for them. And the connections that were made on this day survive up until today. You've had the ultra-Orthodox that volunteered in order to help on the civilian front. You've had soldiers of all types of lives that serve together, some that are from the right, some that are from the left, serving in the same tank against this common enemy that is so clear to all of us. The unity that there is in Israel today is stronger than I've ever seen it. It's stronger than it ever has been, in my opinion. And it's still the case 5 months afterwards. The other thing I want us to look at is to try to look at things in a historical perspective. Because if you would have told my grandparents are from Morocco, or your grandparents, wherever they were from, if you would have told them that there would have been a pogrom against the Jews, where over 1,000 Jews would have been killed, they would have looked at you and said, yes, it's sad, it's a bigger pogrom than what we were used to, but that's life, that's the way things work. But if you would have told them that on the day of the pogrom, hundreds of thousands of Jews of all walks of lives will stand up and will go to defend their brothers, they'll go to defend their independent Jewish state, some of them reserve soldiers that left their families in order to go to defend their nation, they would look at you and tell you, what are you talking about? That's impossible. You're dreaming. But this is the reality we're living in. It's a tough reality, but it's also a reality where we can see that we've moved forward in history. And we're in a place where we can now stand up and defend ourselves. And that's what we're going to do, because we have to, as I said, and we'll do it and we'll also win. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
We'll take some questions from the floor. Yeah, Harvey. Maybe just stand up so people can hear your question.
And just to be clear, any question is acceptable. So you can ask anything you want. No, seriously.
First, thank you very much for coming. Really appreciate it. And you know, you made a very strong argument about the goal of eradicating Hamas. Unfortunately, Hamas and their infinite cruelty forced us to have a goal 1A and a 1B, which is hostages. And I don't see how you can achieve both of those in the way that we want to achieve them. We're talking about temporary pause in fighting right now, which goes against what you were saying. We're not going to be able to eradicate Hamas if we take 6 weeks off and let them regroup. So how do we deal with those two goals that are both primary in essence to us? Because they don't seem compatible to me.
So I say you can ask any question and you ask the toughest one. So it's a tough question, but I'll answer frankly. First of all, I'll say that. In the first hostage deal, I opposed the hostage deal because I thought that it was dangerous. I thought that it would stop the war before we get to the goals of the war. And I thought that Israel wouldn't be able to renew the war afterwards because of international pressure and because a ton of different reasons. I was wrong. I'm happy to say I was wrong. That's number one. Number two, I think that the things that we learned from the hostage deal and also from the dynamics with Hamas is that the goals aren't as contradictory as they seem. You're laughing at my French accent. as they seem. The more military pressure we put on Hamas, the more we see Hamas being able to negotiate in a less strong way. I'll give you, the first hostage deal is a very clear example of that. Hamas did it only because it really needed time off. But I'll give you a recent example. It's very clear that Hamas has started discussing a new hostage deal more openly and more with more flexibility ever since ever since the prime minister made it clear that we're entering Rafah. And so they're obviously worried about that. And so military pressure enables us to get to a hostage deal. And so I'm not sure how contradictory these things are. Now, that being said, I'm still, again, it's a tough thing to say. Definitely, I say it even when hostage families are around, because I stand by the words that I say. But I'll say it here too. It's a tough thing to say, but not every deal is a good deal. And even though we want our hostages home, we demand our hostages to be home, we think it's completely unacceptable that 5 months afterwards, they're still being held against any norm of international law. And we want the world to be with us and scream with us in order to them to be home. As Israelis, we cannot accept any deal. Any deal is not something that we will accept. And so I cannot tell you exactly what the deal will be on the table, what exactly, first of all, I'm not part of the negotiations. That's above my pay grade, as we say. But even when it gets to the table, I cannot tell you whether I'll accept it, I'll support it this time or not support it this time. But again, I think that the contradiction between both goals is less stark than what it seems. And yeah, we have those two goals. I don't think that we can afford to relinquish the goal of defeating Hamas on the way.
Thank you. Fortunately, as you mentioned, that God, we've shown that Hamas can be worn down, and they're showing in the north that jihad did not expect us to go so long. They can be worn down. But in the U.S., we had to fight Al-Qaeda, and in the world, they had to fight ISIS. And they don't disappear. They simply get reduced. So I don't think, because Iran is really the source of all of their ideas. So obviously, what do you mean by eliminate Hamas when the idealism will never disappear, they'll remain international and be backed by Iran?
When we say in Israel eradicating Hamas, what we mean is eradicating the government of Hamas that exists right now in Gaza and all the military abilities that they have in Gaza. They'll still probably exist as a guerrilla group, which will continue fighting as we fight every terrorist groups. That will continue happening, and we'll continue trying to eradicate them even as a guerrilla group. However, this is probably going to be an ongoing goal and not something immediate. The goal of this immediate war is to remove them from power and remove their military abilities. We've already done it with most of the battalions in Gaza. There's around 4 battalions left in the Rafah area, and then which we still need to defeat, and we're going to do it. And that's the immediate goal. Afterwards, the guerrilla war that they'll continue fighting against us is something that we're going to have to continue fighting. But you're right, the ideology is probably going to keep surviving, and it survives, and it exists not only in Gaza, it exists in Lebanon, Hezbollah, and it exists in Judea and Samaria, where we're also fighting Hamas. And since October 7th, we've upped our game there also in order to defeat Hamas there also.
I would say that the further follow-through is that we now have Arab allies.
So that's the second side of the coin, because I started speaking about the military aspect of it. When you're talking about long-term strategy, about what we'd like to see in the region, then what we call denazification or de-radicalization or however you want to call it, everyone uses different terms, but this is a long-term process where definitely we would love to see partners such as the Emirates, which did it within their own borders very quickly and very efficiently. Their educational system is incredibly positive right now, and we wish that that's the education system that would be all around the Arab world, definitely in the Palestinian territories. So yes, this is things that we can see moving forward, but that's, again, a long-term goal, which will take time.
and there's a group of people from Israel who are protesting because of the hostages, and if the Israelis would only... So what I want to know is your perspective about what's going on in terms of aid.
So first of all, there are Israelis protesting aid going into Gaza, and I just want to not necessarily ascribe by their views, but explain why they do that, because I think it's a voice that's worth hearing. They say that there is no other army in the history of warfare that has helped its enemies, even the civilian population of its enemies, during wartime. Israel is doing this. I think it's worth listening to the protesters in order to then answer the critics of Israel, because it's really a precedent that doesn't exist in the history of military warfare. Now, the facts are otherwise, and you're right. Humanitarian aid goes into Gaza. There's actually stocks of humanitarian aid that are on the Gaza side of the Israel-Gaza border, and that are just sitting there because they have trouble, the UN agencies and everything, distributing it. One of the very big problems that they have is that Hamas takes over the humanitarian aid in order to give it to its people and not for it to go to where it's supposed to go. You often see convoys of aid with Hamas militants on them. There's a ton of pictures like that on social media. And so that's the situation, that's the reality. It's not exactly what is told in the media, you're right, but it's another one of the fake news that is being told about Israel. I was thinking of him, but yeah.
So I was going to ask, how does the government think about public diplomacy in the English world as a priority?
So first of all, Elon is my good friend, and I agree with you. I think he's doing an incredible job. And he's another example of the unity that I spoke about in my talk, because a week before October 7th, he was protesting against the government. And now he's working for the prime minister. He's actually working for the prime minister directly. And so that's an incredible show of, I think it's a great show of his own quality of a person, that he's able to put all of his own feelings behind and do what's good for the country. And also it's good for the country. That's just on a personal note for him. I think it's clear that for Israel, the English-speaking world, and let's be frank, America, is incredibly important. We understand that America is the world's greatest superpower still. We understand that it's our best friend in the world. And we also understand that it's a country that is able to help us in the UN and in other places and things like that. We also understand that America is a democracy, and that speaking to the American public, therefore, is incredibly important. And that's why the Prime Minister, over the years, has made it a priority to speak to American media. If you actually look at the amount of time that he speaks, Israeli media says that it's for... cries a lot about that, by the way, just so you know. But if you look at the amount of time that he speaks to American media as opposed to Israeli media, he speaks more to American media than to Israeli media. He invests a lot of time in English-speaking media because he sees this speaking to the public of America is something that's incredibly strategic and important to Israel, because in a democracy, it's a way to influence decision makers. So it's incredibly important. Have we always been good at it? Definitely not. Definitely not. Are we good at it this time? There are some good parts. There are some things that we need to learn and do better. But I do think that there are things that we've done well. I don't want to get into examples, But it's definitely a priority. It's definitely something that we haven't always been good at and that we're learning to do better. Look, I have to say, I'm a little less pessimistic than most people are when it comes to public support and diplomatic support of different countries to Israel. I think that the support that Israel has in this war is unprecedented. Definitely since I'm born. I'm not that old. I'm 38. But since I'm born, I don't remember another time where the world has mostly the free world, right? I'm not talking about the other side. I'm talking about the free world, has mostly stood with Israel, even though it has criticism, right? It has criticism. But if you listen to their criticism, I don't hear many countries in the free world calling for an immediate ceasefire, no questions asked, permanent ceasefire, right? I don't hear a lot of countries in the free world telling Israel, stop the war. I hear a lot of them talking about humanitarian aid, humanitarian pause, the ceasefire for the time of the Ramadan, a bunch of things that we don't agree on, and we definitely don't agree on, and we need to sometimes explain our position, and when our position isn't accepted, stand up and do what's right for our nation, even if there's opposition. But I actually think that for the first time that I remember, when it comes to the goal of defeating Hamas and the second goal of bringing back the hostages, the world hasn't turned on us yet. I am putting this star and saying yet, because I don't know, I'm not a prophet. But for now, I haven't felt this, the pressure of the free world to stop the war.
Jesse. Tonight, President Biden is announcing that the United States is going to build a port in Gaza, as we did in Normandy Beach in World War II, to expedite aid coming in. Is Israel a part of this, or is he sticking it to Netanyahu?
I'll be frank and honest, I don't know. I honestly do not know. I was on the plane here when it was announced, and so I wasn't updated. I don't think it's something that would be done without coordination with Israel. The way I know the relations, usually it's done in coordination. And I'm not even sure that Israel is against that idea. Because we're not against humanitarian aid. Sometimes it's it looks as if Israel is against humanitarian aid and America is for. That's not the way. America and Israel have different maybe ideas about where the humanitarian aid should be given, who should be giving it, and those types of details. But Israel sees it as a strategic need for humanitarian aid to go in, for us to continue doing this war, because we understand what we just spoke of, that if there is a humanitarian disaster in Gaza, then the world will stop us from doing this war. And so we're not against humanitarian aid. And if this is a formula that might be efficient and good in order to provide humanitarian aid to civilians without Hamas taking it over, which is basically the formula that we're looking for, then there's no reason for Israel to oppose it. But again, as I said in the beginning, I don't know. I don't know the plan. I don't know its details. And I don't know what Israel's position is. But I would think, my guess is that it is coordinated. But I'm not sure. That's first of all, thank you. First of all, one thing that I didn't say in my speech, but that I sometimes say, is that before October 7th, there were also a lot of people that If I wanted to be cynical, I would say a lot of people that made a lot of money making conferences about the division between diaspora and the Israel Jewry. But since October 7th, we've seen that at the end of the day, when push comes to shove, we're one people, one very, very strong people united. There's the fringes, right? But I'm not talking about them. The mainstream Jewish people is one people united. And that's very nice to see. I personally, usually when the people ask me, you're not the first person to ask me that, I split my answer in a few categories. First of all, you have a lot of influence as an American citizen on your elected officials. And I know there's elected officials here, right? You said? And so they know what I'm talking about. As an elected official, I can tell you that when I get a WhatsApp from my constituent, I'm influenced by it. I didn't know that before I was a member of Knesset. I didn't know how much power I have as a regular citizen. You have a lot of power. And so use it. Use it. It means speak to your congressman, write letters to the editor, etc. Use that power that you have. The second thing that I usually say also is social media and all of these tools are ways that exist nowadays for every person to be a little media company. And so use that also in order to tell Israel's side of the story. There's way too many people around the world doing that to tell the other side. Way too many people. In numbers, we'll never win because they're much more than us. But in quality and in persistence, we can win. And so use that. And the last, I know that you do that already and that most diaspora communities have done that. But financial assistance for things that are important to Israel is also something that's important. There's been incredible outpouring of financial support with when the war started. I want to also say that Israel will go or is going through a tough economic time because of the war. So I'm not talking only about military needs, and I'm not even only talking about donations. I'm actually talking also about investing in Israel's future. And by the way, if you ask me, it's the best investment you'll ever make, because we'll win this war and Israel will go back to being the incredible economy and country that it was before October 7th. And so those are the three things that I would suggest. It depends who you ask, but you asked me, right? So I'll give you my answer. Look, the minimum answer is what I said before, that all of the battalions of Hamas have been defeated, have been dismantled, and that there's no more battalions. Battalion, that means that Hamas has an army. That's the current situation, right? They still have an army. It's in Rafah and in a few parts of middle Gaza. In the rest of Gaza, we already defeated them. That's the minimum part for it to be a victory. I personally believe that if we are in a situation where there are still rockets on southern Israel, then we didn't finish the job. That's my personal opinion. We have to continue. I don't think that this war is a short war, right? It hasn't been a short war. We're in the fifth month of the war and it's still going on and it's still going to move forward. And I'm not even talking about other fronts yet. I haven't even addressed them today. If someone wants to ask about them, you can, and then I will. But when it comes to Gaza itself, I personally think that without our hostages home and with rockets still threatening southern Israel, then we cannot call that victory. And that's not good enough and that we have to continue. But again, if you ask different politicians, they'll define it differently.
Yeah, Jeff. So you just indicated more. So I wanted to know about so many of Israel's wars have been a response to a violent, intense attack, and Hezbollah has been attacking steadily for a long time. And so there's a lot of talk about an inevitability of a war in the North Pole, so to take care of them, which is going to look very different from wars that Israel's had in the past, and especially after October 7th. So I'm curious what other considerations are happening, especially seeing the world's response to Israel 5 months later and, you know, ceasefire. I feel like the support is really going to wane, especially if there isn't this violent attack with a high death toll that we're responding to. So how is the government and the military taking that into consideration as it plans the attack in the north, or the war that's probably going to happen in the north?
So first of all, thank you for asking the question I asked to be asked. No, but seriously. First of all, I actually just wrote an article on that. My spokesperson is here, and he helped me with that in Hebrew, in Israel, that was published in the Shabbat. Tomorrow morning it's going to come out. We're already at war with the North. In any definition of what war means, look at all international law definitions, we're at war. It's not the most intensive war, but it's war. And so we're already at war with Hezbollah in the north. Now, my personal opinion is that, as you said, the war with Hezbollah is inevitable. Not because I want war, but because I know the ideology that's behind Hezbollah. And if before October 7th, many people, and maybe myself too, were willing to ignore that ideology and close their eyes and say maybe one day things will get better, then now I'm not willing to do that anymore because I've seen what happens when we do that. Now, you're right to say that a war with Hezbollah is a much more difficult war. Hezbollah has hundreds of thousands of rockets. Hamas has tens of thousands. Had in the low tens of thousands. Hezbollah has well-trained soldiers that fought in Syria and have military experience. Hezbollah has much more technology. Its missiles aren't just many in numbers. They're also more dangerous, heavier. And everything that I'm telling you now are things that were published, right? It's not secret information. But it's very clear that a war with Hezbollah would be much more difficult, not just for our soldiers, but also for the home front and for the cities in Israel with rockets that can go everywhere in Israel and attain any city in Israel. And so we know that, but on the other hand, I'm saying what I just said, that war is inevitable, and in my opinion, it will happen one day or another. And so my call to the Israeli government is to actually take the step, and again, not out of a love of war, but out of a sense of necessity, to deal with this problem now rather than later, because another thing that we've learned on October 7th is that the more you wait, the more your enemy uses this time to get better. I mean, we have this huge problem with Hezbollah because we waited. If we wouldn't have waited, then it would have been a smaller problem. And I'm saying all of that also in the context of Iran, because we know that Iran wants to get nuclear weapons. We also know that we will do everything that we can in order to stop them from getting nuclear weapons. But Iran, there's two interpretations of why Iran didn't send Hezbollah in after October 7th. There's three interpretations. The first is less relevant, but it's that it wasn't updated, and there was a little bit of an ego trip that the Sunnis did it without updating the Shiites, and that there was a internal Muslim fight, and they didn't want that. That's one, less relevant. The two other interpretations are very frightening to me, because one of them says that Iran wants to keep Hezbollah the way it is, strong the way it is, in order to protect its nuclear weapons program. Because as long as Hezbollah is strong, then it will deter Israel from attacking its nuclear program. That's a good reason for me to deal with Hezbollah now and not wait for the program to get to where it is, to where it might get. The second reason is even more frightening, is that Iran is waiting for it to have nuclear weapons in order for them to send Hezbollah and then tie Israel's hands because it has nuclear weapons and then Israel can defend itself. It's another reason for us to deal with this now and not wait for it after. And so those are the reasons why I think that we cannot ignore this threat and we'll have to deal with it. And we'll have to deal with it even though it's going to be very tough. And now you're talking about international pressure and Israel wants to do things in cooperation with nations and with the free world. Yes. But if our existential interests are at risk, then we'll have to do things with or without their support. And that's true about every country or any country. We prefer doing it in cooperation and with support and definitely, again, with America, our best friend, etc. But if push comes to shove and we believe that this is existential to us, and I believe this is existential to us, then we'll have to do things with or without their support. After I said all of this, I'll say one thing. There was talk at the inside of Israel on October 8th, 9th, 10th, of whether to attack Hezbollah then. Not only Gaza, but also Hezbollah. The decision was not to. I think it was a very good decision, because I think that we need to focus right now on the front of Gaza. Everything I said about Hezbollah is for when we finish at least the heavy fighting in Gaza, which again, there's Rafah left and then a few other sections. We're towards the end of the heavy fighting in Gaza. And afterwards, we'll have to decide whether we go into Lebanon or not. The official position of Israel is that up until the decision needs to be made, it will do everything it can. I think it's also the right thing to do, right? As long as we don't need to go into a war, we'll do everything we can in order to try to get to a diplomatic situation which answers our strategic needs and our existential needs. You're asking me if I'm optimistic. I don't think this will happen. I'm not optimistic on that. I'm optimistic on many things that you've heard today, but on that I'm less optimistic, and I think that we'll have to deal with the Northern Front once we're finished with Gaza.
Take a couple more questions.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for coming out tonight. Thank you to the elected officials, the police department for protecting us as they always do, and we certainly appreciate all that support. You know, growing up in Borough Park, Brooklyn, with many Holocaust survivors with tattoos, and losing relatives on all sides of my family, I understand the importance of denazification. Not everyone in the world sees that today. When I see polls taken in the Arab population in Israel, Judea Samaria, the West Bank, Gaza, over 70% agreed with Hamas with what they did on October 7th. They agreed with that. That's very disheartening for me to see that this type of extremism and hatred has festered so long and ended up where we are today. And I think that, you know, one of the things that bothers me, and I don't know how Israel deals with this, is that the funding of Iran, who's the head of the snake, who's funding the Houthis, who's destroying, you know, the financial, the shipping lanes, targeting, you know, innocents, funding Hezbollah, the reason they have tens of thousands of rockets and missiles and an army, is because of Iran. Hamas would not have had the ability to do what they did. All the money that America, that the world has given Hamas and Gaza, instead of building and taking all that money and building a city above, a beautiful city, they built below ground in tunnels. They built a terror network and infrastructure to just create terror and destroy. Hamas's charter is not to just wipe out Israel from the river to the sea. Hamas's charter is to wipe out Jews. And this is not just going to start and end in Israel. It's a worldwide thing. And hopefully I'm wrong, but things can happen elsewhere as well.
and we all have to be prepared for that. So how is Israel, A, dealing with the fact that Iran, who has these great nuclear ambitions, being financed, we gave billions of dollars to Iran. Without that money, they wouldn't have been able to do what they did, but what's done is done. So how do you prevent that from happening? And then how do you prevent Hamas and Gaza from, who's gonna govern and make sure it doesn't happen again? You can't trust the UN, you can't trust UNRWA. Obviously, everything I see in the news, things I've seen, pictures, I've been to Israel several times, and I've spoken to family members who are in the RDF, not in the RDF, and everything I've seen, from my perspective, is true. I mean, I've seen pictures, all this stuff is all made up, they say, never happened. So how do you prevent another reoccurrence or build up of Hamas? And again, I agree with what you said, you have to destroy them.
Totally. So first of all, one thing that's very clear is that Israel will remain in military control of Gaza. We've made that very clear. And remaining in military control, that means that no other group will have the ability to build weapons and arsenals that will be able to attack Israel. We've made it very clear that after we left Gaza and the disengagement plan, as you said, the Hamas regime took over and then used all of this potential for progress in order to just build more and more terror. And so we will not let that happen again, and militarily we'll be in control. The question of who will be in control on civil matters is something which, to be frank, divide Israeli society. And because we're so intent on staying united right now in order to keep our eye on the ball, which is victory against Hamas, so we're keeping this question for a later period and not right now. And we'll decide once we defeat Hamas, we'll get to the discussion within Israel what the right format is. The Israeli government has already made a few statements, however, about what not, which I ascribe to 100%. First of all, not Hamas. That's obvious. The second is not the Palestinian Authority, which supports terrorism by paying salaries to the families of terrorists. I mean, they actually pay salaries to the family of terrorists, including those who did the October 7th attack. They educate people to hatred, etc., etc. And so they're not an option. UNRWA, not an option, because they cooperated with Hamas, and they also educate to hatred, and they perpetuate the problem of the refugee problem instead of solving it. So not an option. So these are not options. We'll have to create an option. Will it be based on, there was a question here on the moderate Arab countries, Emirates, that have done denazification, if they want to be involved. I think that would be a very positive thing. I don't know. We're not there yet, but this will be a question that we'll discuss after victory is here, hopefully.
Donald, let's ask you one last question. Can you give us something positive that we can, a message for us as we close tonight?
I thought I give many positive messages, no? I give positive messages, but I will repeat a positive message that I said beforehand. I'll say like that. Sometimes, I think it's Rabbi Nachman that says that, but you're the rabbi, so you'll tell me if I'm right or not. that sometimes it feels like you're in a low point, dafka, when you're going higher, right? And I really, really feel that we're in a situation like that right now, both because of the unity, an incredible unity that there is in Israel, also because of the historical perspective that really, if I'll say in one sentence, the reason why I made Aliyah is because of this historical perspective. And I feel that we're in an incredible period of time where the Jews are coming back to their land after 2,000 years of exile. And I wanted to be a part of it. Obviously, I didn't want to be part of October 7th. But if we look at the whole perspective of the larger picture, we're in an incredible period of time. The last thing that I will say, which is also positive, is that we'll win. And I promise you, we will win. Thank you.
Adrian Meyer is downstairs in 5 minutes in the Baby Drash. We thank you very much. Thank everybody for coming.